Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Burrow is a furniture company known for timeless design and thoughtful construction, and free shipping, and that extends to their outdoor collection. Their outdoor furniture is built to withstand the elements, featuring rust-proof stainless steel hardware, weather-ready teak, and quick-dry foam cushions. For Memorial Day, get 15% off your Burrow purchase at burrow.com/acast, and up to 25% off outdoor. That's up to 25% off outdoor furniture at burrow.com/acast.
That's the second time it's gone off.
They never go home, those boys.
That's... Yeah. They have asked for that, really.
Well, you can laugh. It was the World Cup.
I'm a little bit of an idealist. But having said that, I want to be like me.
You don't know what you're talking about.
What did you know?
I managed to stay alive for 6 days.
I'm going to leave it there.
I'd say it to your face, and I'll say it to you now.
I'm down Swanfield, and we'll see them, won't we?
What you doing down here, you shawny man?
You thought you'd lost the ability to feel emotions watching a game of football, didn't you? So many months of empty stadium matches, so many goals chalked off because of that lot in Stockley Park. It's okay to admit it. You were afraid that football had lost its ability to make you feel happy, to feel sad, to feel much of anything at all. You might have been starting to think the unthinkable. Maybe I'm falling out of love with the game. And then this weekend happened. Arguably the two most emotive moments of the entire season distilled into one weekend, the penultimate weekend of the Premier League slash, well, it was the ultimate weekend of the FA Cup and the penultimate weekend of the Premier League. Ken Murph, hello there.
Hey, Owen, how's it going?
Welcome everyone to Monday Second Cabin's Football Podcast. Well, I'm good, Ken. I'm still living off the highs of the weekend's football. First, there was the FA Cup final, which was actually a series of emotional moments all wrapped up together. The Yuri Tielemans screamer, the actual screams of the supporters inside the stadium. Brendan's joy. He was going around whispering sweet nothings into the ears of his players and hugging the owner. In fact, the outpouring of affection from the players to their beloved owner was another lovely minute or two. All of it was encapsulated in the shaky voice of Gary Lineker, Leicester born and bred, who was presenting the BBC's coverage.
Wow, they've done it. Four times they've reached the final, four times they've lost. In Leicester's 137-year history, they've finally won. They finally won the FA Cup. Leicester City have done it. Alan, save me, please.
Alan, save me, please. Indeed, I have to say, having gone so long without watching much football with the supporters inside the stadium, to see there were a lot of whammies there, you know, one after the other from the goal on. And I must confess, I only started watching after an hour. So I got to it and I thought, great, I didn't miss much. And then immediately Yuri Tielemans slams one into the top corner. And I'm like, I'm so invested in this sporting occasion that I didn't turn on until just now in this last couple of moments. Mm. And from that moment on, it was quite an intense, say, 45 minutes from the goal going in to the disallowed goal for Chelsea to all those celebrations that I mentioned. And it was certainly, I'm speaking for myself when I say I felt something again, Murph.
Actually, a really nice moment from Lineker a little later on in the post-match when he said that his father had been at all four of the finals that they had lost.
Yeah.
And he started cracking up again, which was really, really nice.
Well, the thing about Lineker is...
It was very emotional.
Like Lineker's support of Leicester, it feels quite benign to the rest of us. You know, we've talked ad nauseum on the show about the new dynamic in football punditry.
Well, we think it's Neville versus Gary Neville.
Yeah, but nobody cares when it's Leicester who are being supported so brazenly.
Yeah, and
but he supports Tottenham as well, doesn't he? He supports Tottenham and he supports Barcelona. I mean, it depends.
Well, he does carry on a bit about Barcelona. He's not really about Tottenham, does he? And Everton. Played for, won the league with Everton,
I
of course, didn't he?
Lineker gets this, Ken, sometimes on Twitter. I think Lineker's a legitimate Leicester fan. He grew up supporting them. His dad went to all those cup finals. He went to the matches as a kid. He played for them, and now he supports them. I think that's legitimate enough.
I love that first thing Ken contributes is that Lineker is a plastic supporter of Leicester. He's a jolly come lately to the new overlords of English football.
Just see, he's a man of many. He's a man of many faces. You know, depending on who's playing.
No, I think it's just kind of well-meaning congratulations or commiserations with the other showers. But with Leicester, it's, you know, a full-on love affair. I think he's made that quite clear over the years, to be fair.
It was a genuinely thrilling cup final to watch. A reminder of the pulling power the football can have. But we do have short attention spans. We need constant reminders of why we love this sport. And we got another one the very next day.
O relógio já passou dos 49 prometidos pelo árbitro. Cai a chuva. Que tensão. Cobrança de escanteio. Alisson! Gol! Alisson!
What a moment. What a header by the Liverpool goalkeeper, of all people. And brilliant interview afterwards. So much good stuff going. We'll leave that for the report on sport. I know you want to get into Alisson there, Ken. But I think it's all set up for an exciting week now. Liverpool out again on Wednesday night after Chelsea play Leicester again on Tuesday. We're going to cover all of that over the next few days. Also on the World Service this week, the Players' Chair returns. And this episode is not to be missed. Richie is back with an extraordinary conversation with the former Meath great Liam Hayes, who speaks movingly about his life and in particular trying to deal with the tragic death of his brother, who died by suicide aged 24.
My mum has said that to me many times. Anytime she's spoken about George, she's normally brought it up to say, listen, didn't the football save our lives? She said that many times to me, nearly all the time she says that to me. And she says, oh, you were a great fella. You know, you brought us all out of the dark place. You brought us to Croke Park and you were able to go out in the field and you were able to do this and you were able to do that. Which is lovely to hear your mother saying that you were, you know, you were able to get beyond the experience of finding your brother dead in the football field and you were able to go back to that football field because, you know, the place where I found Gerard, I was back there training within weeks. But again, that's because I'd run fast and far mentally away from the night.
Yeah, it's an exceptionally powerful episode of the Players' Chair. That's going to be out tomorrow for World Service members. That's all on top of last week when we had a big reaction to pretty much all of our shows. The housing crisis chat with Aidan Regan, Game That Changed My Life with Marcus O'Sullivan, and our conversation with the Chief Executive of Dublin City Council, Owen Keegan, about his dream of a whitewater rafting centre in Dublin. A dream not necessarily shared by all, but that's all there for you anyway. There's a lot of good stuff available right now and it only costs £5 a month plus VAT. You can sign up on secondcabins.com. Ken, please, report on sport.
Look, if you'd asked the man in the street what he wanted, he would have told you he wanted a faster horse. You know? just because nobody seems to want a whitewater rafting. No, we're not gonna go whitewater rafting again.
Well, we've got a mini podcast today, Ken. There might be a little bit of whitewater rafting in there for you.
But not that we can move straight on to Alisson now.
Well, look, there. You know, Alisson, like that was. I mean, I'm lost for words with this moment because it was just, well, to be honest, I experienced it strangely. I'm not inhabiting quite the same time as everyone else. Watching these games on Sunday, I'm usually watching them on Now TV, which means I'm lagging a little behind the world because Now TV is an inaccurate name for what it in fact is. And so I had no indication.
5 minutes ago, TV.
As the Liverpool got that corner in the fifth minute of 4 minutes of injury time, I had no indication that something extraordinary was going to happen, apart from the 15 WhatsApps that simultaneously arrived from everybody I know who watches football and doesn't have to watch it on Now TV. Screaming, oh my God, oh my God, oh my God. So I was able to watch this almost as though it was a replay, sort of knowing what's about to happen. But then to see Alisson just in bits afterwards, we'll play a bit of his interview because the interview, play it at all, but
Alisson, just the most extraordinary moment. Give us an insight into your emotions right now.
I'm too emotional. There's this last month for everything that happened with me, with my family. Football is my life. I play since I remember as a human being with my father. I hope he was here to see it, but I'm sure that he's seen with the God on his side and celebrating. It's for my family, for the boys. I can't be more happy than I am now.
Was it an incredibly emotional celebration for you?
Yeah. I've been away from interviews for a long time. It was a difficult time because always when I talk about it, I get emotional on that. But I just really want to thank all of you, all the Premier League, all the players. I receive letters from managers, from teams, from, for example, Everton and Ancelotti, all the players. Man City, Chelsea, I don't want to be not fair with the others that I don't remember, but I just want to say thank you for everybody, for the supporters, from the team. If it wasn't you, I could never get through this, because I'm just away from my family since the thing happened. My family, I mean my mother, my wife, have been amazing with me. My kids give me energy. And this is what we feel, the love from God. This is the way God loves us, through people. And we should do that every time, every day. But I just want to say thank you at this moment. And the celebration, I don't know how to celebrate that.
I mean, yeah, that, what he's been through, you know, he said he hasn't seen his mother, you know, since his father died. One more week to go, basically, and I guess he can go home. But like, when you consider all the, like, how crazy that has been, you know, I mean, he's been playing all through this, yeah. And like they've also had a baby, I think, himself and his wife have had their third baby. So when you consider like just the level of kind of extreme emotion that he's been through this entire, like, you know, months long period, for like, because what happened in the game, I mean, it's like Klopp said, you know, it's only football, but it means everything to us. It means a lot. Like, that was their most important goal of the season. I mean, until the next time they need another goal to keep them, you know, alive in the sort of Champions League. I mean, this is the situation all these clubs have got into. They're addicted to the money. They can't go cold turkey from the Champions League money, or, you know, the club implodes. That's what's on the line. And in that game, it really seemed as though they were done. You know, they'd missed chances. You know, the first half, Mane and Firmino both missed good chances. Second half, Wijnaldum and Alexander-Arnold had missed good chances. There was lots of nice little interplay outside the box. Nothing really being created at the end of it. And the game's already over. And all West Brom have to do is clear one more corner, which they've been doing with great ease all game. And then Alisson, I mean, just incredible.
How did Alisson succeed there where so many other goalkeepers have failed? Not every goalkeeper. I mean, it's the odd goalkeeper over the years. Peter Schmeichel scored one or two. But generally, the goalkeepers come up. It looks spectacular. You think, wow, it would be amazing if this goes in. Jimmy Glass would be the famous one in the lower leagues of English football.
But what a header. What a header.
Absolute bullet of a header, yeah.
Well, I'll tell you, it's only the second best goalkeeper header that I've seen scored from a corner in recent weeks.
Who was the who banged one in?
It was none other than Mark Travers' own. I don't know how did you miss this? Mark Travers.
This is shambolic. Hang our heads in shame here. God, Mark Travers.
I'm desperately agreeing.
You're like, who is Mark Travers? You're doing it. You're actually doing it.
Who the devil are you?
Who the devil are you, Mr. Burns? Yeah. No, it's Mark Travers, the Ireland goalkeeper, the wandering goalkeeper of Belgrade. He does like to wander outside his area. And recently for Bournemouth, he did it to considerably more effect than he managed in Belgrade against Mitrovic when he came and ran. And honestly, now, I mean, here, Alisson has scored this unbelievable goal, and I'm talking about Mark Travers, but I got to say, it was an even better. It was unbelievable because he ran. It was similar to Drogba in the Champions League final. You know, it was like that sort of run to the front post, a leap, and then bang. just absolutely nutting the ball in. So all I'm saying is Alisson isn't the only goalkeeper who can do
this.
Hold
on a second. I've just watched two goals from Mark Travers.
What?
He landed one in from like 80 yards out 4 years ago his debut.
4 years and ago? That, I mean, he's only 21 yeah, I know. Now.
This is ridiculous.
He's 20.
The man
he's
can't
22.
Stop scoring.
He's 22 tomorrow, actually. But happy birthday to you, Mark.
His header. Yeah, I'm looking at it quite well. Take a bow, Mark Travers, say Bournemouth, and they're dead right. It looks almost identical to, very similar to the Alisson goal, except from the opposite side.
Mm.
But I mean, so far you've managed to take credit away from to accuse Gary Lineker of being a plastic leather City supporter, and you're now trying to take away Alisson's claim to scoring the best headed goal by a goalkeeper this season.
In terms of what was on the line, notwithstanding that there was probably a lot on the line from Bournemouth's point of view in the Mark Travers game, the Alisson one was a big moment. I mean, it's arguably the moment of the season. I mean, again, not if you're Chelsea. I mean, if you're Chelsea, from Chelsea's point of view, this has not been a good weekend.
No.
This really hasn't been a good weekend. Because the other thing that was happening was all the videos from the Chelsea fans showing the Chilwell goal, or actually Wes Morgan own goal, but the last minute equaliser that they scored in the cup final, only for VAR to cruelly but correctly rule that Ben Chilwell was fractionally offside. Ben Chilwell, who celebrated, like, you know, again, I'm reminded of Drogba in the Champions League final. Ben Chilwell was pretty pleased to have scored against this former club. Mind you, the supporters had been booing him. I don't really understand why. I mean, like, obviously,
standard former player playing against them now, having gone to a bigger club. Fair.
I mean, they got well paid for Ben Chilwell. I mean, it seems to me like Leicester came out of that deal feeling pretty good about themselves. But still, I suppose, you know, it's never nice to see a former player. And then Chilwell absolutely over-celebrated, all the other Chelsea fans.
David Kiernan says, I can't help but think Chilwell's hubristic knee slide and subsequent humiliation at the hands of VAR will spark a renewed era of meek celebrations for players scoring against their former clubs. Hopefully not, David. Hopefully not. I mean, I enjoyed the celebration of Ben Chilwell. Although, like most people watching, I did at that point very much feel invested in a Leicester victory, so it was kind of hilarious when the goal got chalked off for VAR. I also forgot how much fans actually love VAR, really, you know, when it goes for them and a big goal is chalked off against an opposition. It's like you get to celebrate your own goal again, as the Leicester fans did in this game.
I think it's a net negative still.
I know, I'm being facetious, Kenneth. It's an absolute net negative, but that was a nice moment for the Leicester fans.
Sorry, yeah, no, it was a nice moment, yeah, but it was rubbing it in. It was nasty stuff. You know, I think the Chelsea fans felt worse in that moment than the Leicester fans felt good, if you know what I mean. So I think it does remember, it's only half time in Chelsea versus Leicester. Leicester have been given the FA Cup, but now there's this game tomorrow. Again, anyway, we're going to talk more about that with Miguel and with Jacob, who were at Wembley for the game. I mean, it was just a pretty incredible weekend of football in general. I mean, in Spain, Luis Suarez scores a late winner for Atletico Madrid, which is probably going to win them the league. I mean, what they need to do is beat Valladolid in the last game. And if they do that, they're going to be the champions. If they draw and Real Madrid win their game, then Real Madrid will be the champions, because even though Atletico Madrid have better goal difference, it's not about goal difference. It's about head-to-head.
Thank you for letting me know that, because I was just glancing at the table this morning and I thought a draw would probably do the job for Atletico, but I didn't realize head-to-head came first.
A draw will probably not do the job, unless...
Sorry, Murph, you seem very...
Come on, like, no, you just have to do better than that, Owen. Come on. Everyone knows the head-to-head still counts in Spain.
There we go.
I had the exact same inner monologue last night, so it's all
but
good.
But Suarez, like, he... you know, it's kind of amazing what's happened there. You know, Barcelona got rid of him. And, you know, maybe they got rid of the wrong man. Mm-hmm. Maybe... No, you're not. No,
I don't. I don't think Leo Messi's.
Leo Messi's done okay for them as well. So
well, maybe the mistake was getting rid of anybody. No, I don't think so either. I think we spoke about this earlier in the season. I think Suarez probably had to leave there, but just because he can play well for Atletico and a team with players who run around him, doesn't mean that he would have been as good with Barcelona as himself and Messi stood there with their hands in their hips watching their 9-man team concede yet another goal. Although Messi was doing that anyway, around the same time Suarez was scoring for Atletico to turn their 1-0 into 2-1. Barcelona were losing at home to Celta Vigo, meaning they're out of it, meaning that Ronald Koeman is probably going to be sacked. I suppose that has a knock-on effect for Liverpool as well, because if Koeman isn't there, then it's hard to see how Wijnaldum goes there. Although we'll see what happens. As for Madrid, they won, but it was all this sort of talk then was about, oh, Zidane has said he's going to leave. So Zidane said this is a lie. It was reported on the Cero on the radio networks. He says it's a lie. I haven't said anything. How am I going to say to the players I'm leaving now? We're fighting for the league, and I say that I'm going? No. I'd never say that to my players. Why would I say that? At the end of the season, we'll see what happens. We can't constantly talk about my future. It's not the most important thing. Everybody expects him to leave. His contract runs until next year, but apparently he's had enough of it, and he's on his way. It's kind of a weird approach he has to management. Just sort of like, yeah, I'll do two and a half seasons, and then, you know, win a couple of things, and then
it is a pretty good system when it's Real Madrid. Like, there's no way. You know, if someone's going to have the job for any longer than 3 years anyway. So he can take 3 years off. Hmm. He can go back, do another kind of 2-year stint, probably win the Champions League, take another 3-year break. I mean, in many ways, he'll never have to look for another job. It's literally Real Madrid have his phone number. No other club has his phone number. They just call him whenever they've sacked the guy that took over from him the last time.
Yeah, it's interesting. I mean, because, you know, he has won again in this return. He hasn't managed to win the Champions League again, but he did win the league last season, which was, albeit a weird league, it was still a major victory, you know, for Madrid. And okay, losing to Atletico is not good for any Madrid coach, but there's still a possibility that he, I mean, it's not unknown
stranger
for Atletico
have
Madrid
happened.
Than for Atletico Madrid to mess it up on the last day by drawing their last game. I mean, that is definitely in the realms of the possible. The same thing could happen in France. PSG won yesterday. Lille only drew, so they need to win their last game. Germany, Lewandowski equaled the record of Gerd Müller. Dortmund got the Champions League. So these things are beginning to work out. Now, Dortmund have sealed the Champions League. They looked for a long time like they weren't going to make it, but they're back in now. Juventus beat Inter, which means that they'll probably make it as well, because the three teams that are ahead of them, they're still behind three teams. So, you know, if those teams all win, then Juventus are screwed. But those three teams all have to win. So if Juventus win, then the odds are they will make it. Because surely one of those teams ahead of them is going to screw up. So what else is going on? The Ferguson documentary.
Oh, you can now speak to us about this. You mentioned late last week that you can only begin to talk about it this week.
Well, they're the restrictions that are in force, and they're the restrictions that are in place. On a scale of 1 to 10, how much would you say you're looking forward to hearing Alex Ferguson talk about his career again? It's not as though his career has been undocumented.
No, I'm looking forward to it quite a lot. I read the Donald McRae interview with him last week, and certainly Donald made it sound as though it's a pretty, very watchable documentary. A lot of good stuff on his working class roots in Glasgow and so on.
Yeah, it's interesting.
Is it good? Is it worth it? What are we giving? How many cans out of 10?
Well, I mean, I quite enjoyed it, but I'm sort of watching it also through this haze of nostalgia. You know what I mean? But then again, I'm also hoping
you'll get a column out of it as well, which you did, and which I very much enjoyed, Ken.
I'm the target market for this. You know what I mean? Like, I am. This film is in my sweet spot, just in terms of it enables me to relive moments of my life when I was younger, when the world seemed a kinder, a brighter place than it does today.
So I tied an onion to my belt, which was
and
the style.
Alex Ferguson was around a long time as Man United manager, so the sweet spot is pretty big. You know, even people a lot younger than yourself, Ken, who
as big as Bryson DeChambeau's driver sweet spot.
There we go. And he's still a figure now. I mean, we still, like, everyone's still familiar with Alex Ferguson today. So I don't, I would imagine if it's well made, and it's made by his son, isn't it?
Son is Jason is the director, which is interesting. But yeah, I mean, for people who are younger than me, maybe they won't find as much in this because he everything after the treble is just left out. Like, I think there's one shot of Ronaldo in the film. Like, there's one shot that I remember anyway, which is Ronaldo leaping to, like, head in the goal in the Champions League final in 2008. And, you know, there's like Rooney's bicycle kick gets in there. There's a couple of bits and bobs, but nothing. All of that stuff, it's just doesn't feature. Everything after the treble is just left out.
Right.
It's like, well, it's like we were already at the top of the mountain, and we stayed at the top of the mountain for a few more years and won all these trophies. But like, really, it was all about getting there. You know, that's what it was all about, or at least that's what we've got time to put in the movie. That's what we consider to be most important. Because you do think actually this career is too big for there to be a movie. They should make more.
A ten-parter.
The Last Dance, yeah.
Well, really, you know, because like a lot of it is Ferguson's anxiety over... It's like this brain hemorrhage that he had in 2018, in May 2018, is a real... Like, obviously, is like... It was a shocking moment in his life when I guess there's a moment when all of us really kind of come face-to-face with mortality, or the idea of our own mortality, which is something that ideally we're not really thinking too much about too much of the time, you know. And sometimes then you're in a situation where, well, this is, and what he then became really anxious about was this idea of, as can happen with brain injuries, he had a hemorrhage and he needed surgery to address this bleed, that you can come out with brain damage, which, you know, suddenly it's all gone. You know, his memory of his career is gone, and this idea really seemed to terrify him. I mean, I don't know if he was sort of fixating on that as a proxy for, you know, his actual death, but it's certainly what this movie is kind of about. Like, it's kind of his memories. So these memories are very tinted by nostalgia as well. So I'm kind of watching it. It's a nostalgic movie for me to watch, but then the movie itself is also like Ferguson having an extended fit of nostalgia. Like, it's super nostalgia, and like the shipyards, like the beautiful, you know, these massive industrial installations. We used to think they were ugly, but now that they're gone, we can see that they were magnificent, right? Yeah, yeah. You know, the soot-smeared city, you know, the fires of Mordor, like, and all that kind of stuff.
How green is my valley, basically?
How green is my valley? Is that... No, he mentions that. He mentions that film in his autobiography, actually. How green is my valley? And he does actually. He does. He literally mentions the feeling of the miners and how green is my valley, as that. But not in this film. But yeah, that's he likes the movie. But he's a movie guy, Ferguson. You know, like, he compares Govan. Not in this movie, but in his book, to the Govan where he grew up as like the resembling the New York of the Godfather Part Two, you know. And you can see in his office when he's, you know, his office at Old Trafford or the Cliff, or I don't know, wherever his bloody office is, where he's got portraits of, like, Humphrey Bogart is one of them, you know what I mean? Like, he's these movie gangsters and sort of Western heroes, all this kind of stuff. Where was I before you?
You were talking about the beautiful shipyards of
the beautiful shipyards where Alex Ferguson, of course, never worked. Like, he never worked a day in a shipyard. His father.
I think that's why you could be so positive about the shipyards. You know, if you looked at them, but didn't actually work in them.
Well, his father, you know,
I learned so much from avoiding the shipyards.
So you know, I watched this other documentary about him as well. From 98, the Alex Ferguson story. Like, this was on ITV back, like, you know, it's around the time of, remember they played Monaco in the Champions League quarterfinal, Trezeguet scored and they got knocked out. It's from around that time. So they're sort of following Ferguson in, like, a couple of weeks of his managing Man United in 98, and then interspersed with, like, his backstory, you know, his history going back to the shipyards and all that kind of stuff. And it's interesting just to see the difference in tone. You know, like, say, for instance, in that 98 documentary, they sort of frankly, the narrator just says, you know, Ferguson, everyone basically worked in the shipyards, but Ferguson escaped. You know what I mean? Like, there's no dicing around the thing that, like, this is just, you don't want to have to end up there. You know what I mean? Mm. Like, Ferguson's own father had like a mangled left arm and was missing the thumb on his right hand from, you know, industrial accidents. This is the type of stuff that, like, was just normal. You know what I mean? Like, when we're looking back on this magnificent shipyard, and, like, the size of these ships, like, you know, the camera is, like, sweeping up this hull, which is, like, towering over the city. You know, you're up on the deck of this thing with all the workers, and, like, you can see for miles. Like, it's so high up. And there is this kind of, well, you know, that's, we used to build shit here. You know, that kind of, this pride, like, that he's trying to tap into. You know, of course, he literally never, it would have been a nightmare for him to get stuck there. You know, his father made him do the tool making, do an apprentice as a tool maker. And he's like, oh, you know, help me understand people. But mainly it seems to have helped him to understand he didn't want to work in a factory and would do anything to escape that. There's all this kind of nostalgia from Ferguson, which is sort of interesting. It's like, it's nostalgia for a life he didn't actually live.
Yeah.
But he's absorbed by osmosis, you could say, the values of this community, where basically everyone worked in the shipyard. You know what I mean? But, like, Strachan then provides a note of realism in this, because Strachan just talks about how angry Ferguson was. There are only three players who are interviewed. For three players, so out of all the hundreds or thousands of players he's had, who feature in it, who are now being interviewed now and giving their thoughts about it, they are Strachan, Cantona, and Giggs. Giggs, who actually is due in court on May 26th, and the film is out on May 27th, which isn't good timing, yeah. Obviously. But Strachan just talks about how sort of angry Ferguson was.
And Strachan's an interesting one, because that if you're only including three players, and one of those players is somebody who's associated with not enjoying, not having a great relationship with Alex Ferguson, as far as I know, Strachan's background.
But I think they must have made up, you know. I think they must have sort of put it, you know, obviously Ferguson's not going to have him in the movie. I mean, it's not like it's Jason Ferguson's movie, but, like, he's not going to put, like, a sworn enemy in the movie, I don't think, at this point. You know, it's just, I think they must have patched things up. I mean, Strachan sort of seemed to be trying to sort of escape from Ferguson, and I'm not sure exactly, I can't even remember why they fell out. Like, Ferguson said something like, I wouldn't turn my back, I couldn't trust this man an inch, I wouldn't turn my back to this guy, like, you know, with the implications Strachan would have his knife in your back, kind of a mad thing to say about someone. You know, in terms of, like, what, well, you've had a football disagreement. But like, Strachan's talking about, there's something inside this guy that's making him angry and driving him on. And the thing that it is made quite clear in the movie, is what happens to Ferguson at Rangers. And this is another interesting difference between the 98 movie, the 98 documentary, and this one. In the 98 documentary, he's talking about the Rangers thing, and they talk about the cup final, the 1968 Scottish Cup final. Ferguson is the Rangers centre forward. They play Celtic. It's the biggest crowd ever to watch an Old Firm game. To this day, 132,000 people are there to see Alex Ferguson lose his man, Billy McNeil, at a corner for Celtic for Billy McNeil to head in Celtic's opening goal on the day, right? Would they have known Ferguson was meant to be marking Billy McNeil? Did Ferguson know? Yeah, he did know. I mean, you can see him. There's a great shot of Billy McNeil, you know, scores the header, and Ferguson standing just behind him, putting his hands to his head. You can see the blue shredded figure in the number nine. Just, oh no. But Rangers go on to lose the match 4-0. At one point, John Gray, who's like the Rangers centre back, tries to dribble from his own, or does he pass? He tries to pass the ball past, is it Lennox or Murray? I'm not sure which Celtic player it is. At the edge of his own box, he just passed it straight to a Celtic player who runs past him and scores. And I'm like, that's a worse mistake than Ferguson made. But of course, John Gregg is like the greatest Ranger, right? He is like, he's like a legendary figure in the history of the club, you know, you could get away with mistakes like that if you were John Craig. You couldn't if you were Fergie. And why not? Well, because, as Fergie says here, because I was married to a Catholic. I'm sure of it. And I don't think he's said this before as explicitly. Like, in the book, he talked about Rangers directors, and he retells the stories here, who were bigoted. You know, the press officer was bigoted. I can't remember the guy's name, but he does name him in the book. Another director who says to him, "Oh, you know, is your wife a Catholic?" When he's signing, this is, and he's like, "Yeah." Yeah. He goes, "Well, did you get married in a chapel and he's a registry office. "Oh, that's okay then." And Ferguson in this documentary says, "Well, I should have told him to fuck off, but I didn't, because when you want to sign for Rangers, you're prepared to take nonsense." So this is what I think. This is what he really hates about them. He spinelessly kind of just went along with that. As spinelessly as he now sees it, he didn't sort of do what he now feels like he should have done, and stood up for his wife, who he describes as a devout Catholic in this film, by saying, "Sorry, you know, that's not..." He just kind of went along with that. And then a couple of years later, they scapegoat him for this cup final. And he is still furious about it. Like, it's 53 years later. He's still incredibly angry about it. But he says explicitly, like in the 98 movie, Martin Ferguson's brother is in that, and he says, "Well, there was a lot of politics going on at Rangers at the time." And that's as far as he goes, you know what I mean? But now it's like, I was scapegoated because I was married to a Catholic. I'm sure of it. And so that's what he says. So I think that's kind of an interesting thing for him to say.
And his playing career after that,
Didn't ever play for Rangers again.
Play for Rangers again. Okay, no. So it properly messed up his playing career.
Made to train with the youths, humiliated as far as he's concerned, ostracized from the club, and sold off eventually, buried at Falkirk. They thought, well, hopefully we'll never see him again. And then he literally spends the entire rest of his career fired with the passion to destroy Glasgow Rangers. Like, that's, you know, remember his mad interview after the cup final, the Aberdeen
the maddest
beat Rangers.
Of mad interviews. Yeah.
Like, it's utterly insane. You're like, Ferguson, you are insane. You're a fanatic, an absolute madman. He's there. He's like this rabidly angry man whose team has just won the Scottish Cup, right? Aberdeen have just won the Scottish Cup, beating Rangers 1-0. And it comes to him and he's livid and starts savaging his players. It's a disgrace of a performance. Miller and McLeish played Rangers by themselves. It's a disgrace. We can't take any pride out of that. It's a disgrace. And he's like, "Well, I really wanted to put the knife in Rangers." Like, they hadn't beaten them. Like, he wanted to destroy Rangers. Like, he wanted Rangers to go home crying. And instead, they got away with a 1-0.
4-0 would have had a nice ring to it.
4-0 would have been nice. So, yeah, there's that. Like, you know, how can you still be angry? Well, he still is angry. But then there's the whole... What was interesting, I thought, about the movie, or another interesting thing about it, is Jim Leighton is in this movie way more than, like, Ronaldo. Like, there's 5 minutes of Jim Leighton. There's 105 minutes in the movie, and five of them are about Jim Leighton. And that was like, because this is the same thing. You know what I mean? Ferguson's most, the most bitter and painful memory of his career is being scapegoated after a cup final. Although there were obviously some aggravating factors there which we've been speaking about, but what happens to Jim Leighton in 1990 is basically the same. Like, he's talking, and like, it's kind of hard to understand. Maybe, you know, we've been talking about the FA Cup whenever we've talked about it in recent years. It's usually been, well, nobody really cares about that anymore. Obviously Leicester, big game for them on Saturday. Maybe the game tomorrow is even bigger. But in 1990, this was the biggest game that you know in sort of English club football. Jim Leighton had played how many cup finals? Like, four or five cup finals for Ferguson before. He'd won the Cup Winners' Cup. He'd won all these Scottish Cups. He'd been with him then in Manchester United. Then he's going through a wobble. He's having a bit of a wobble. Big Jim's having a wobble. And we get to the cup final against Crystal Palace. And the first game is 3-3. Big Jim... First goal is a bit of a weird one, a set piece which kind of loops in under the bar. The last Crystal Palace goal is a cross from John Salako, which Big Jim comes for, then decides, no, that's too high. Then he watches tragically as it go all the way over his head to Ian Wright at the far post, who volleys it in. And Big Jim has definitely had a couple of wobbles in the game. Big Jim is out. Ferguson is like, and Archie Knox is there, the assistant at the time, and it's like, well, you know, Archie would have played Big Jim. He would have stuck with him. But he'll tell you that it's only due to his loyalty to Big Jim. That, and you're like, well, loyalty, is loyalty not your whole thing? But no, there are different types of loyalty. This is an example of like the trolley problem. You know the trolley problem in ethics, where it's like, well, there's a mining trolley coming along, or a rail, and like, you know, there are five people tied to the rail, and it's gonna hit them unless you pull a lever which diverts it onto a track where it only goes over one person. Do you do it? Or do you simply stand back and say, I don't know what to do. The dilemma is too hard. Ferguson's just like, pull it. Jim Leighton's tied to the rail. Well, Big Jim's got to go. It's like he knows how bad it is to be scapegoated for like a bad cup final, but he does it anyway. These are the decisions that you have to make if you want to win. Like, Jim Leighton's career is basically just a burnt offering that Ferguson had to make to get the ball rolling at Man United success-wise. And like, obviously he's never spoken to Ferguson since, because like he said, I went to his room to tell him, he burst out crying. It's like absolutely horrific. But and something which Ferguson, it's interesting that there's so much made of it in this, because it's only one episode. There've been loads and so many episodes, but this is obviously something that really sticks in his mind. And he says stuff like, he says, if there's a doubt, there's no doubt. Like, that slogan, like, that's like a slogan from 1937. This is mad. Like, you know, if there's a doubt, there's no doubt. Well, okay, like that, but that's literally the Stalinism. You know, poor old Big Jim, he didn't make it. We move on. That was the first trophy, and many more followed. But yeah, it's a good move. You lose a friend, you lose someone you've given the first opportunity to in life. That's how Ferguson comments on it now. You're like, he still thinks he did Big Jim a favor. Like, he's still like, I gave him, you know, basically his career was a gift that I gave, as opposed to I played him as my goalkeeper because he was like the best goalkeeper I could find. You know what I mean? Which is also another way of looking at it. But look, yeah.
Sounds good. Out next week.
It's good. It's out. I think it's May 27th. I'm not sure. You know, the release dates are always a bit. It's out soon anyway. And I think it's out in the cinema, but it's also out in Prime. I think it's Prime Video. God, I should really have to.
7.5 Kens out of 10.
I'll give it a few. I enjoyed it, but not everyone is as steeped in the history. I mean, what if you're like a younger Man United fan? You're like, he's left out the entire bit that I remember. Must seem a bit strange. But that's the way it is with old guys.
According to Donald McRae again, who did include the information at the bottom of his article, Sir Alex Ferguson Never Give In was released in UK cinemas from 27th of May, that's 10 days from today, and available on Amazon Prime Video from the 29th of May. So there you have it.
1850 715 815.
Hello, good afternoon, and you're very welcome to Lion. 51551 is our text number, and Joe at RT.ie from wherever you are in the world. Ken, good afternoon.
How are you?
You saw it. What happened?
I mean, I actually was abused by a Dane as well.
Mm-hmm.
The night before.
Go ahead.
I was having dinner after the you know, we finished our work or whatever on the Friday, went into town. We were sitting in a restaurant.
You were a journalist and
myself and three other journalists.
Mm-hmm.
And at some point it turned out we were all looking at our phones simultaneously.
Mm-hmm.
We were waiting in a bill or something. Mm-hmm. And this Danish guy staggered up from behind, sort of suddenly leaned over the table, and he goes,
"Go ahead.
Is there a Wi-Fi? Is there a Wi-Fi in here?"
The whole thing, Ken, the whole thing is getting more and more bizarre. You didn't do it, did you? Did you report that to the FAI or anything?
We were like, actually, we're just still on the 3G. Mm-hmm. Before we could finish explaining we weren't actually on the Wi-Fi, he goes, "Wi-Fi wankers! You're all Wi-Fi wankers!"
Did he write this himself? Did he compose this line himself?
You know, all he'd seen was four. I don't know how he knew we were Irish, but he knew. Wi-Fi wankers! Mm-hmm. You're all Wi-Fi wankers!
Miguel Delaney and Jacob Steinberg were both at Wembley on Saturday for The Independent and The Guardian, respectively. An event that it was a privilege to be at, you said, Miguel?
Yeah, just as opposed to be at a mass outpouring of humanity and human emotion for the first time. Even during the game, and especially in that last half hour after Leicester scored, and it was so tense And it was almost like as if every moment on the pitch was being amplified by the atmosphere, which of course is something we haven't really seen in a few in so long. I've been at a few games with crowds since, but they've been so small, so it's not quite the same. And this felt like the first proper event. And during that half hour, that final half hour, I was thinking like it was probably the best sporting occasion I've been to since probably Liverpool 4, Barcelona 0, I'd say. Just for everything wow. wrapped up into it.
That's two years ago.
Yeah, yeah. And obviously there was we had almost a year of normal, non-pandemic football after that. But just in terms of kind of, I mean, both what happened on the pitch and how what happened on the pitch was informed and kind of electrified by everything around it. Because, I mean, like I said, it's my piece yesterday as well, the follow-up we did on Leicester, whereas like in a lot of these moments, especially moments like with Leicester's, where the story is usually that they finally ended that FA Cup drought. They've won after four defeats four previous final defeats, three in the 60s, all the rest of it. It's kind of all the little moments around the players and what happens in the dressing room and interactions. But here, like, it was impossible not to keep looking at the footage of the fans and little reactions in the stands because we haven't seen this for so long. And I mean, it was, you know, quite special in that regard.
Yeah, I have to say, even watching it on TV, Jacob, it was almost overwhelming. There was so much from the moment of Tielemans' goal through the overturning of the Chelsea goal to all the post-match stuff. Lineker was emotional. Brendan Rodgers was obviously very emotional. The owner being brought out. There was so much going on. It was amazing. It really was quite an emotional thing to look at. I mean, you were there for... I suppose the biggest moment was the goal. It may as well have been 80,000 fans in the stadium, the way the noise that seemed to be generated. What was the feeling in the stadium at the time, if it's possible to describe a feeling?
It was really strange for a start, being in a crowd and hearing noise. You know, the first time I felt that was when we had the protest before the Chelsea-Brighton game about the Super League. And you're like, oh my God, I've been going to games since June and hearing nothing. And then out of nowhere, for no reason other than the Super League, you're suddenly hearing people making noise, which is pretty weird to kind of experience in itself. And then on Saturday, turning up, you know, we're going to these games where, you know, it's absolutely nobody there. You're going on empty tubes and you're turning up and there's nobody outside the ground. And then on Saturday, seeing, you know, not to its normal extent, in as it would be in normal times, but seeing people on Wembley Way and walking through crowds of the Leicester fans were the ones on Wembley Way mostly. And, you know, walking through all of those guys and just seeing them so excited before the game, you start to think, oh my God, this is what actually football used to be like. And got into the, you know, there were only 21,000 people inside the stadium, but the noise was, it was probably better than it might have been for quite a few finals that have been with 80 or 90,000, however many it is that normally are inside Wembley. The noise was incredible throughout. The Leicester fans were clearly, I think they were more up for it than the Chelsea fans. That might be because we were closer to them, but I sensed that they made more noise, and this was a really big occasion for them. The goal when it went in, as I'm saying, you know, every goal that that more or less, apart from the period where we had 2,000 fans in over December and November, had just been greeted by a wall of silence, and this was just this outpouring of emotion. And it was one of the only moments as well where VAR felt like it was something, you know, that it came in handy. That moment where obviously the Chelsea fans went absolutely mental, and then I was looking at the Leicester fans who were near us, they were all just slumped back into their seats and looked absolutely devastated. And then that moment where I was looking at on our little monitors and thinking, hang on, Chilwell looks like he's offside here. And you see that moment where it comes up on the big screen, checking goal, possible offside, and you know, greeting that moment where you know, for the Leicester fans, it was greeted like it was a goal, whereas, you know, for basically 2 or 3 years or however long it's been now, we've just all been moaning about VAR. This was the only moment that it felt like it was something that was a force of good, basically.
Well, maybe not from a Chelsea point of view. I mean, how did Leicester actually do this, Jacob? Because I mean, in your write-up, you seem to lay a lot of blame at the feet of Thomas Tuchel, a failure of nerve compounded by a catalogue of tactical errors.
Yeah, I thought that he got quite a bit wrong on Saturday. I thought that on Friday he said to us that that finals are not the moment for to try out new tactical tricks, and that, you know, essentially you don't want to start messing around with anything. And then we turn up on Saturday afternoon, the game starts, and you know, hang on, Rhys James is playing as part of the back three, Azpilicueta. And admittedly, Azpilicueta has played as the wing back in a few games recently and done it quite well. But Azpilicueta is playing at wing back in this game. And I thought that, well, we knew that it was partly because he was worried about the pace of Jamie Vardy on the break, and he wanted Rhys James up against that. From my perspective, I'm thinking, well, Jamie Vardy has two goals in 2021. He's not the force that he once was. Whether that's just fatigue this season that he'll come back, who knows? But I don't think there was any particular reason to be so worried about Jamie Vardy. And so already, just in that one moment, it seems like you're worrying more about Leicester's strength than your own, that you're, you know, almost compromising one of your own big parts of the game, which is Rhys James's crossing ability. That if you look at the Leicester goal, it comes about a minute after Azpilicueta gets into a really good position on the right and just sends a really bad cross straight to Schmeichel, when it was one of the few moments really that Chelsea were in a bit of space. And on the other flank as well, for a start, you know, Aspie is really not, well, he's not as quick as Rhys James. And then it's compounded by playing Marcus Alonso over Ben Chilwell, who made a really big difference when he came on, you know, almost scored and had the involvement as well in the disallowed goal, much quicker than Alonso. And I think that one of the issues that potentially is going to flare up a little bit with Tuchel is, if you look at his record in finals, you know, he's not got a great record in them. He was accused, I think, quite a lot when he was at PSG of being a little bit too cautious. You know, things like, I was told, things like playing Marquinhos in midfield when he was at PSG. You know, PSG, he managed to lose one of those cup finals when you would think that's kind of impossible with the resources that he had there. I think that was one that went to penalties. You know, three of his finals have gone to penalty shootouts. And I just thought that he seemed to go a little bit too cautious on Saturday. It may well work for them in the Champions League final, because you know, Manchester City are going to come in and you'd imagine dominate possession and be the more aggressive side, and that may well suit Chelsea with the you know, with the pace that they've got on the break and the way that they've already played against Manchester City. But I do think that there's a bit of an issue there with Chelsea, and it's kind of again compounded by, you know, that system that he plays. He's got seven defensive players in the side almost at times, and they just don't create many chances. And while it's worked for them in quite a few games, there have been others where it's left them, you know, they've left themselves a little bit open to something like Yuri Tielemans banging one in from 25 yards out, and then they don't really have much of a response to it because they don't create enough.
Yeah, what about from a Leicester point? I mean, we talked there about Tuchel's record in finals. Brendan Rodgers pointed out casually that he's been in a number of finals before. I think he said, "I've been in six finals before, and I've been lucky enough, says Brendan, to win them all." Miguel, it was more than just luck yesterday, though, wasn't it? Or on Saturday. I mean, his team deserved it. And let's be fair, Brendan Rodgers deserved it too.
Yeah, absolutely. And I suppose, I mean, even the, just, I suppose, with Jacob talking about Tuchel's maybe over pragmatism there, Rodgers has shown a bit of an evolution himself, particularly at Leicester over the past 2 years, I think, where this is probably a much more calculated side than we'd have previously associated with Rodgers. It's much more built in kind of defense, or maybe not so much defensive solidity, but the sort of structure that means they can be difficult to get at. And on Saturday, I thought it was very much, Leicester didn't really take the initiative, bar a few spells with a sudden breaks, and even the goal came from that. It was really a transition. Whereas, you know, we've all heard the classic Rodgers comments in the past about death by football, all the rest of it. But it was basically, they almost sat off Chelsea here and allowed them to do damage themselves before hurting them. So I think it shows an evolution in Rodgers as well. And let's not forget as well, for all he says about the finals, he has maybe had, all right, it's a bit of a limited period so far, but he has had a little bit of a track record at Leicester that this season was threatening to do again, where of getting them to a certain point and not taking them over the line. I mean, last season's Champions League was obviously the biggest example of that. It's under threat again this season. And so, you know, a final defeat here would have, it had that danger of something growing about Rodgers, about me, you know, not being able to, I suppose, push the button when it came right down to it. So it was a really symbolic win from him in that way, but also one that feels like it's maybe bringing him onto the next step of his career, especially as there's so much talk, I suppose, about where next and what next. I mean, you know, and I suppose that's an interesting thing for, a question for Leicester as well, in that I suppose prior to this, or for maybe a lot of the last few months, Rodgers would have felt maybe a logical choice for Spurs. Yet, from everything you hear now, he's got no interest in moving to Spurs. And also, it doesn't feel like it's that the obvious or logical for him, because he's almost got Ferguson control at Leicester, from everything you hear. And also, Leicester, even though there's still a bit of a difference in resources, Leicester feel like they're in a kind of in the short to medium term, at least, they're in a better shape than Spurs to compete.
So are you telling me that if that job, I'm not, maybe Spurs, the one that interests me with Rodgers is Arsenal. Just because Arsenal seem to me like to be, Arsenal are the greatest opportunity in English football at the moment. You know, they're a gigantic club which has fallen into ruin, and that's the perfect club to take over. You know, if you don't want to take over a club that's doing well, I mean, you don't want to be Moyes in 2013. that's not the club you want to you want to take over. But are you seriously telling me that if, or, I mean, you know, Mikel Arteta is still in the job. I mean, he won this competition only last year. He was the toast of Wembley as recently as last August. But are you telling me that if a job like that came up, that Brendan Rodgers' ambition, that his statusometer wouldn't immediately be telling him, yes, Brendan, you're taking this offer. You know, all due respect to Leicester, Arsenal are 10 times bigger than Leicester.
I think he already has bigger sights now. And I suppose we might get into definitions of bigger clubs now. But
in Man United.
Of, well, the big one that people talk about is that he's expected to
replace Real Madrid?
To succeed Pep when Pep eventually leaves Manchester City. That he feels like an obvious choice there. That is doing the rounds, genuinely.
But that's the Moyes mistake. It's like, oh yeah, I'll follow Pep. I mean, that's just obviously.
Brendan Rodgers. Why is it so ridiculous? It's just because it didn't work for Moyes doesn't mean
Brendan Rodgers
doesn't mean a manager can never do well after another manager.
There is a difference there. I mean, Manchester United in 2013 were a club. The empire was crumbling because so much of the empire was connected to how one specific man worked. That's not quite the same situation with City. It's okay. Everything is built towards. Not so much Guardiola, but Guardiola's ideology and the way he manages. It's not the specific whims of how he wants to scout things. Like, it's an exceptional infrastructure, Manchester City, as it would be when you basically, when you're a state project. But everything in the club runs very, very well, which is very different to what Manchester United was in 2013. Now, I suppose maybe it's more of a psychological factor in terms of trying to compete with or outdo what Guardiola did, or even match it in any way. But even then, I suppose it points to the fact that Rodgers now, right now, he can afford to think a lot bigger than struggling big clubs. You know, he's going up as they're going down.
I suppose the other thing that needs to be pointed out in terms of whether he might think of Arsenal as a big job, Arsenal are a bit of a basket case when it comes to the ownership. Whereas at Leicester, you know, they just run so well. That's why they're able to disrupt and challenge the elite. If you look at some of the players who played well for them on Saturday, look at someone like Wesley Fofana, who is 19, 20 years old, bought from St Etienne last summer. Absolutely brilliant. Kept Timo Werner in his pocket, matched him for pace. Yuri Tielemans, why is he playing for Leicester? He's easily good enough to play for one of these elite clubs, but they aren't clever enough to buy someone like him. Wilfred Ndidi, again, one of the best midfielders in the Premier League, was bought from Genk 3 or 4 years ago. You know, Leicester are just much smarter than a lot of these clubs, and they don't make stupid decisions, and that's why they're able to punch above their weight. I wouldn't really see why Brendan would think about taking on one of these struggling super clubs when you know everything is kind of made for him there.
Because those things don't last, Jacob. Like, you know,
the, yeah, but Leicester.
I
mean,
I remember the last time Leicester had the biggest brain was when your man Steve Walsh was signing, you know, Kante and all this. And like, I mean, he wasn't able to keep that up. I mean, he went to Everton and pretty much flopped. You know, Liverpool for a long time, it was, oh, you know, like Michael Edwards only signs gold. And now it's like Minamino, Ben Davis. You know what I mean? Like it's Naby Keita. Like, you know, you could say, well, we're great. You know, we know what we're doing. We sign good players. And say, for instance, this, you know, they've managed to sort of replace, you know, Harry Maguire quite well. You wouldn't even notice, you know, they've sort of, they've lost big players and been able to go on, but that can't possibly keep happening.
No, maybe not, but it'll be interesting to see what happens if they get into the Champions League and how they respond to that and what that does for their ability to maybe spend even more and maybe potentially as well even hang on to some of those players for a little bit longer as well. I mean, they are just really smart. You know, when we talk about Harry Maguire and how they replaced him, one of the things was that they already had the replacement at the club and they gave him, and that was Soyuncu. You know, I know they that summer when they sold Maguire, they had people sort of coming up to them and offering this or that central defender to them. They said, actually, we've already got Soyuncu at the club. We've given him a year to settle in England, and look at him now. He's a 50 million centre-back who probably the, you know, teams like Liverpool, Manchester United would think about signing. I just think that they're very clever. And as a West Ham fan, I am quite jealous of the way that they run the club and the way that they're able to, you know, the way that they're able to challenge it. I think they're really embarrassing as well. Some of the supposed bigger clubs as well, in the way that they do it. I don't think that there's much of a reason for Rodgers to walk away, unless, as Miguel says, it's something that's really, really big and pretty solid and just makes absolute sense. You know, something like Arsenal, there's no point to it.
Just in reference actually to what Jacob said there, that's one thing that should be said about Saturday as well. And as one thing that kind of leads into these bigger discussions about Leicester, I almost felt, there was a point to me on Saturday, as great as I almost thought, well, this club that has only had two trophies in the last decade and has won these two trophies for the first time, they're really spoiled. Because just from this perspective of, they've had two once-in-a-lifetime moments now in the space of 5 years that some clubs don't get ever. And obviously, like, just winning the FA Cup on its own terms isn't necessarily that big, especially in the modern game. But there was so much more wrapped up into this for Leicester, given that it had been so long, given that, you know, the club for most of its history, really, or sorry, for 50 years, had actually been defined by failure in those three lost finals in the 60s.
And they also it was a good cup run as well. I mean, they beat Man United on the way as well.
Yeah. But it does feed into these big questions about what next for Leicester as well. Is this, and I am minded to agree with Ken a little bit there. And obviously, Leicester qualifying for the Champions League would change the dynamic again. But the history of these clubs that go by purely on excellent recruitment is that you can't keep doing that indefinitely. And as soon as you have one drop off, it can usually lead to bigger cracks if all true. The biggest example of that, I suppose, is Southampton, who just couldn't keep fending off all their players being taken every year.
But that's already happened to Leicester, Miguel. I mean, that happened after, you know, I think Jacob was about to make that point, that this has been going for a few years now. They lost Kante, you know, they lost Mahrez.
But there is a weird distinction.
And they've built back from that
summer after winning the league, where actually the recruitment really was poor, and they ended up, I mean, partly that was, you know, a bit of a drop-off under Ranieri, but they ended up, you know, almost in a bit of a relegation battle that season. So you have seen that they've been able to recover from that, from a bad summer, when, you know, a lot of the signings didn't really come off and they wasted quite a lot of money that summer.
The one thing I would say that, though, there is this kind of weird distinction in Leicester's recent history in that it's almost like the title, all right, obviously there's a few players that carry through, like Vardy, but it's almost like the title was part of a completely different era of the club, even though it was only 5 years ago. The team was constructed in a different way. Even Steve Walsh, you know, as good as he was for those years, it wasn't quite the same, you know, infrastructure recruitment that we see now. And he did bring to those two players. But even the first 11 was more makeshift. The football was a totally different style. It was kind of, it just wasn't as evolved as what Rodgers is doing now. And it's almost like they rather than this being a continuation of what the title was, they used the title to just go in a completely different direction of the club and really bring in all, you know, use it to essentially complete this infrastructure, to put something different in place and become a model club. But I suppose all this is why what next is so interesting. It's also why tomorrow night is so interesting. But
this is the thing. You know, sorry. Were you about to say something else?
No. Just I think both myself and Jacob are at that game tomorrow for a match that could almost be as intense as the cup final.
Well, absolutely. And, you know, I saw Tuchel made the players stay and watch everything after the game. And he said, well, this is just respect. But I thought, yeah, this seems like this is for Tuesday, really, isn't it? Like, let's stand and watch them enjoy this, because on Tuesday, surely, is when Chelsea get their revenge. I mean, I feel sorry for Leicester that this is... You know, usually you win a cup like that, you don't have to play again until, you know, for a couple of months, and everybody can just sort of go on holidays feeling happy. And instead, they've got to come back and play the same team in a, you know, I'm sorry, but when you get down to it, more important game for all their careers and for all their salaries than the very beautiful occasion on Saturday.
Do you remember in 2012 when Chelsea beat Liverpool in the FA Cup final and then turned up 3 days later and just looked very, very hungover at Anfield and lost 4-1 to Kenny Dalglish's Liverpool with Andy Carroll and Stuart Downing looking like, you know, Messi and Suarez, basically. So, you know, that is a bit of a... Miguel thinks... I've been arguing about this with Miguel since Saturday evening, I think. Miguel thinks that Chelsea are going to win, and I'm quite worried for Chelsea, because I think if Leicester aren't hungover, then if they just play the same way, Chelsea have had quite a few problems at home against teams who don't give them any space behind the defence, basically. I think that they could run into a bit of bother, and Tuchel's under a lot of pressure now that, you know, he went on this amazing run for so long, and now he's had two defeats in a row for the first time. You know, it could have been two trophies and the top four. One trophy's down. There is the chance that he's going to end the season outside the top four, although it's still in their hands, and without the Champions League, you know, with the caveat that they could beat Manchester City. And then he's in the position of having 1 year left after everybody talking about, you know, the extension of the contract. Although he's obviously made a very good start. You know, the standards and demands at Chelsea are so intense and at times unreasonable that I think that he's already under a bit of pressure after that.
You've got to be kidding me. Like, I mean, he's lost two matches.
I understand, but this is a club that, you know, sacked Conte a year after winning the league. They sacked
Conte had fallen out. Like, Conte was, let's
see what happens with Tuchel when he's, you know, when things go bad. I mean, look at what happened to him at Dortmund and PSG. You know, he's in a great mood right now, but I'm interested to see what happens when things start to go bad at Chelsea, because look at what it's done to so many managers.
Yeah. What do you think? What do you think, Miguel? Is Tuchel's time up?
I wouldn't say that yet. I do think there'll be a response for all sorts of reasons, you know, including making the players watch. And it's quite weird the last two games. Like, obviously, say Chelsea were nowhere near as intense replied as they were against Madrid only a week previously, but the structure was broadly the same, and it did feel like almost an issue. Okay, I do accept Jacob's points about the tactical changes on Saturday, but that feels a little bit divorced from the kind of the wider form of the team, and it felt more like an issue of application. And even the Arsenal game, really, they should have won that given the chances they had laid on.
Sorry, he's lost three games. I'd forgotten about that game. Of course,
yeah. If they can inject a bit more application, which I think will come from maybe the context of the situation, having just lost that final, Leicester potentially just maybe not on it to the same degree because they won on Saturday. I'm relatively confident Chelsea will get the result. I mean, if that happens, it suddenly calms everything again. But I suppose it is just given this club and given the kind of the stakes of the season. It is interesting how quickly it's gone from everything going great and you know, we could really have an all-in of, as Jacob said, two trophies and a top four. And now one's gone, top four is suddenly fraud, especially after what happened with Liverpool yesterday.
So I'm not talking about what I think should happen. I'm just talking about how Chelsea tend to behave when they lose two games.
But who can they get? Like, I mean, they've got this guy's like... I mean, you know, I know that this is a hypothetical discussion, but like, he's been really good. Like, there aren't that many coaches on his level just knocking about. I mean, are Chelsea going to have to go and pay Leicester like £30 million to hire Brendan Rodgers. Is that like is that what they're looking at? Like if you know, surely Dougal, regardless of what happens, gets
well,
a
look, I mean,
season.
David Moyes is going to be potentially out of contract next year, so maybe he'll be available. I mean, look, I don't think they're going to sack him this summer or anything like that, but if he doesn't get the top four, if he doesn't end up with a trophy this season, he won't have as much credit in the bank. And he does have, they gave him a short contract, and that's partly because they got burnt after giving Conte and Mourinho very long deals and ending up immediately having to sack them and paying loads of money out. It's just, I just think that it's a little bit of a dangerous fortnight for him, given the long-term future. I'm sure that he is going to be the manager at the start of next season, whatever happens in these next 2 weeks, but it's going to make, I think, next season much easier for himself if he, you know, if these next 2 weeks go better than, than it started on Saturday.
Yeah, no, it is. there's a lot riding on this game tomorrow night, guys. That's brilliant. Jacob, Miguel, lovely stuff. Thanks a million.
Cheers.
Cheers, guys.
It was totally insane. Jesus Christ. Oh, my God. It's coming back to me now. Oh, my God.
What happened?
After the game, I came back on the metro from the stadium to Nevsky Prospect. It was like basically Russian Arthur's Day. They're all beating their horns. They like rev their engines. You've got terror of death. You think you're going to die. Loads of people had these balloons of what I assumed was laughing gas. Hippie crack. Raheem Sterling hippie crack. I was sorely tempted. I was like, I really should try the laughing gas. What happens if I fall over and hit my head? And then I watched as a girl took a great big out of this balloon, right? Yeah. This balloon. And so I was sort of giggling. And then just eyes rolled back in the head and she just fell backwards like poof. A couple of minutes after that, so this time a man, probably 30-ish, pitched forward onto his face. I thought, oh my God, I can't believe this just happened again. Smashed down onto concrete with his chin. He'll never chew normally again. He's gonna be half dead. But in fact, again, he was all right. Old titanium jaw. What a night, what a city, what an adventure for the host nation.
Well, we fairly teed up that match tomorrow night, Chelsea against Leicester. I mean, I thought for a moment Jacob was going to tell us that he thought Tuchel was gone if he lost that match, but he stopped well short. In fairness, Tuchel himself said when he took over, look, I'm going to get sacked very quickly if this doesn't go well. I don't think he's under too many illusions that were he to not qualify for the Champions League, having lost the cup final, a bad start next season, and he is gone, you know?
Yeah, but really...
There's a few ifs there, because they could obviously win tomorrow night, and they could obviously have a great start the next season, but losing the cup
final...
And
win the Champions League.
Yeah, they could. I mean, there's still... I didn't factor
in the Champions League final.
I think if they win the Champions League final, his job is safe till at least Christmas.
And but it would be sad to think, did we sack Lampard just 1 week too late? You know, if we just acted a little bit serious, all that give him time stuff, maybe just cost them. I'm not sure, but I would still back them to do it. Like I would expect them to beat Leicester tomorrow night.
I also think Tuchel's a brilliant manager, by the way. It's just, you know, we all know how Chelsea operate, and I think successes, the memory of successes fade pretty quickly in this at that club, and then get rid of their manager. So we'll see what happens tomorrow night. We'll obviously be talking about all the football, and as I mentioned at the top of the show, loads more on the World Service over the next little while. So you can sign up now on secondcaptains.com. Thanks a million, Ken.
Thank you too, Owen.
Thanks so much, Kieran.
Thank you, Ken. Thank you, Owen.
Cheers for listening. Take care.
It's the second time it's gone off. They never go home, those boys.
It is not war and death and famine. It's not that at all. It's the opposite of that. It's to persuade that there's a world outside of that. That's why sport's important.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.